Velkommen til podcastet, der handler om, hvordan du kan få ting til at ske med inspiration til hjerte, hjerne og fødder. Det er adfærdsledelse på lyd. Velkommen til en rejse fra intention til handling. Rejsen starter her.
In this episode of the podcast Behavioral Management for Years, I talk with Professor Dilip Soman. Dilip has a Canadian research chair in behavioral science and economics and served as the director of the Behavioral Economics in Action Research Center at Rotman. His research is in the area of behavioral science and its application to consumer well-being, marketing and policy. He is the author of the book Last Mile and co-editor of the latest book, The Behavioral Informed Organization. In this podcast, we talk about how to make change happen that would not otherwise have happened in order to create change with impact in organizations and in society for the greater good. Today, I talk with Professor Dilip Soman, and congrats with your new book, Dilip, and welcome to this session.
Thank you so very much. Thanks for having me.
In this book, Dilip, you talk about how to make your organization human compliant. And we're going to talk about how the behavioral informed organization make change happen and why this approach to organization and change creates impact for the greater good. But before we go into that, Dilip, please, what do you do? Tell us about what do you do in your everyday life when you are not doing this podcast with me here?
All right. It's a long journey, so I'm just going to very quickly summarize the journey that brings me to what I do now. I started off many years ago as an engineer and working in sales. And it was an interesting experience because at that point in time, I learned that as engineers, we try and spend a lot of time and energy trying to optimize and maximize and design for efficiency, when in fact, our customers don't care much about those things. I mean, they care a little bit, but at the end of the day, the color of the machine is important, or whether they feel secure or they're taken care of. And so that took me on a journey to try and study first business management, and then I spent some time in advertising, and eventually went on to get a PhD in behavioral sciences at the University of Chicago. And I've been in academia since. And since my journey in academia began with my observation in organizations, one of my passions has always been to see how I can take the science back to an organization. And so while I think we have an outstanding science of behavioral science, I don't think we have a good science of how to use the science. And so that's been sort of my mission. So at the University of Toronto, I lead an initiative called the Behaviorally Informed Organization Initiative. That's the title of the book that you just spoke about. And we work with several government, for-profit and not-for-profit partners with the goal of trying to see how we can best embed the science to improve processes and, in fact, help the organization attain its broader goals. So that, in a nutshell, is what I do.
Wow, that's interesting. And I've been so happy to use a reference from your interesting studies and research and articles in my own book and come to learn a lot about your specific way of doing this mapping of theoretical thoughts within practical context. So it's a pleasure to read that and to talk with you today, Dilip. Do you have a story, a picture, a metaphor that we can use for this behaviorally informed organization going through our talk? Is there any example or something you said, okay, the listener could might be think of an organization working with this or that to try to get a hold of this organization here?
I'll give a metaphor. And I think the metaphor comes again from my days in engineering. And because I'm an engineer, I see everything as a series of boxes connected with pipes. I'm a mechanical engineer, right? So it's all about moving fluid, let's say, from point A to point B. And so as an engineer, when I'm working with a hydraulic device and I want to move fluid from A to B, there's two things I need to do. I need to create a pressure differential across A and B so that the fluid flows from A to B. And then I just want to make sure that the pipes are clean. Now, this is a metaphor that works for all kinds of things. It works for electricity. We need a voltage difference and we have to have low resistance. It's the same story. It's also the story of behavior change. And what I mean by that is if you want to move people from any behavior A to any other behavior B, we want to make sure they're motivated. That's our pressure differential. And we want to make sure that it is easy for them to move from A to B. And to me, that's the metaphor that has explained a lot of what I do in terms of thinking through how organizations can use behavior change. So let me just give you two quick follow-ups to that, and then maybe we can jump into great detail. So the first thing is the notion of keeping the pipes clean. What does that mean in our world of behavior change? It means that we need to make sure that processes are simple, that we don't create unnecessary friction. But you look at some of the things that our organizations do, little things like, you know, applying for leave and the forms that are needed to be filled to apply for leave. Or if you're a citizen and you want to apply for welfare, the amount of forms that need to be filled and the complexity of the process, right? These are all things that can be avoided. And sometimes we lose people. You know, they don't engage in the behavior change we want them to engage in. Not because they don't want to. We just put friction in their way. And it's not that we intend to do it. So I think keeping the pipes clean translates into doing simple, you know, what we call them sludge audits, making sure it is as easy for people to do the things we want them to do, right? So you remember back in the days of the Palm Pilot, right? That we had this wonderful handheld computer, the forefather of our smartphones. And I remember reading somewhere that the person who designed the Palm Pilot said that one criteria that we have is that you should be able to accomplish anything on the Palm Pilot with three taps of the stylus on the device, right? And that's it. If it takes longer than three, then it's too complex. And I think we need something like that for our organization. So I think that's one quick thing. I think the other quick thing is the notion of motivation, right? We often assume that our customers, for example, are motivated to do the kinds of things we think they should do. I mean, I just had an interesting conversation with a mortgage broker last week who was trying to convince me to change mortgages because at the end of the thing, I would save like 0.001% or something along those lines, right? And I was trying to tell him that the hassle cost of making those changes to me were not worth the benefit, right? And sometimes we lose track of that. We have our metrics for what customers should do. And if customers don't do that, we kind of say that they're irrational. So I think, you know, that metaphor helps me and a lot of the organizations I work with think about, have we understood the customer motivation and are the pipes clean? Have we made it easy for people to do that? And I think that explains a lot of the challenges that companies face.
Yeah, okay. That's two great examples, also good metaphors to have going through this talk. So let's jump right into segment number one. What is actually then this behavioral informed organization? In your great book, The Last Mile, you are addressing the hard problem why many of our change projects fail at the last mile, getting from good intention to actually act on the things and make things happen. In your latest book, you claim, however, that everyone is in the business of behavior change. Can you please unpack that for us? Why is everyone in business and organization in the business of behavior change?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, Hendrik, because it took me 30 years to figure this out. Like, you know, every year people ask you, you've done all this research, you work with government, you work with for-profit companies. Like, aren't they very different? And yeah, they're different. But at the end of it is a behavior change challenge. So why are we all in the business of behavior change? Because no matter what you do, at the end of the day, success is defined by getting some stakeholder to react differently, right? So let's start off with my dietitian, right? My dietitian wants me to move from eating certain kinds of fatty foods to a healthier diet. My doctor wants me to, you know, to move to a regime where I'm getting an annual checkup. I, as an educator, want my students to do things differently. You, as a consultant, want your clients to do things differently. I mean, without getting people to do things differently, our work basically lacks meaning. And so I think that's the one thing that ties us all together, is that at the end of the day, we want stakeholders to behave differently, be it a habitual change, be it a one-time change. And in the book, we talk about four different kinds of behavior change challenges. So obviously, there is sort of the compliance challenge. All of us face that. You know, there are rules and regulations. There are things we need to do. How do I get people to do those? Those are fairly common. A lot of people understand
that.
Yeah,
we have been through a lot in Corona, going through complaint.
Haven't we?
Corona, I mean, compliant behavior, yeah.
So I think that's a huge one. But I think the standard, you know, one that jumps out at most marketing people is just brand switching. Like, I've got people buying brand A, which is my competitor, I want to get them to buy brand B. But that's the same switching, you know, my doctor's example, that's also a switching behavior. You know, don't eat this, eat that, or don't watch too much TV, go exercise. Consumption is a big behavior change challenge. Sometimes you want people to consume more, sometimes you want them to consume less. One of the biggest challenges in this country, and I suspect in many parts of the world, is how do I get people to consume medications on time? You know, we all come back from the pharmacy with our prescriptions, and then one of the biggest challenges is medications where you don't get immediate feedback, right? So cholesterol medications or diabetes medications. If you miss the occasional dose, you're not going to feel any different, but obviously it's going to accumulate and the consequences are not good. And so how do I get people to consume that? And then I think the hardest of all is the fourth challenge, which I call acceleration, which is the idea that all of us know what the right thing to do is. I mean, I have yet to meet a person who has told me that they don't care about their retirement, or they don't want to spend time with their family, or they don't want to live a healthy lifestyle. Everybody wants to do it. But when will we do it? Tomorrow. And so the challenge is, how do I get people to do it today at the right time before it is too late, right? And so when you think about these four classes of behavior change challenge, and you look at any organization, any profession, we do at least one of them. So I think it is very central to everything that we do. Of course, the footnote to all of that is, I don't think we are very good at... We're not very good at engineering behavior change. So I think that's where there is a huge opportunity for behavioral science to contribute to organizations.
Yeah, and that's a really good structure and system and a way to see a window into these four kinds of engineering path, so to speak, and just trying to identify what kind of change is actually going on and what are we going to make happen here. In the foreword of the book, The Behavioral Informed Organization, the author of this book is the famous guy, Kay Sunstein.
That's right.
Originally wrote Nudge from 2008, and I think it's out in the last and final edition now.
That's correct.
He wrote that together with Richard Taylor. And he was also a former advisor for Obama. And now I quote, he writes something here, and I think we could use that as an in-flight to our narrowing down the behaviorally informed organization, how they work and how that organization looks like. And I quote now, nudging and behavioral informed approaches in general are out of their infancy, but they are still in their early teenage years. There is so much more to be done to save money, to improve health, to prevent premature death, and to increase well-being in general. The nudges themselves need to be nudged. The book, and now he means your book, helps point the way. But what is that for a way that Case refers to here? What is that for a way that you direct us in your book?
Yeah, so I think I'll just make a quick comment on the first half of the paragraph that you read. I think, yes, he's absolutely right in that we have moved past the early years. I think the first 10 years of nudging were about, I call it cheerleading, right? We used to go to organizations and say, isn't this a wonderful new science, right? Now people have tried it. They have gone past the early success and met some early failures. And now they're struggling to make sense of it. Now they're asking questions about scaling up, for example, right? Like, okay, we've done pilot studies. What do we do to launch this market-wide or organization-wide? So I think we are getting to that stage where the science of using the science is becoming a bit more complex. So the way we think about helping organizations is to go back to the fundamental premise of the science, which is experimentation. Right. And so our science is all about saying, look, you know, we know that certain behavioral interventions have effects, but they have those effects in particular conditions. So unlike physics, where, you know, if I take this object that I'm holding and I release it and I ask you to predict what's going to happen, you're going to say it's going to fall down. In behavioral sciences, it turns out that, you know, it's going to fall down, but sometimes it depends on whether the object is red or green, or what my ethnicity is, or what language we're speaking, because a lot more factors conspire to create a behavioral phenomena. And what that means is a intervention, a strategy that worked for you, Henrik, in Copenhagen, might not work for me in Toronto because we're in a different context. And therefore, it is critically important to test everything before you deploy it. So what does that mean? It means that we need that infrastructure for testing. And, not a surprise, companies weren't built to do science. They were built to do something else, right? So when I'm in a university, I have a process in place. I have to get ethics approval. I have a laboratory space. I have somebody who knows how to deploy the experiment. We can quickly collect the data. We can analyze it. Doesn't happen in companies. And so one of the biggest barriers for organizations to use the science, in my opinion, is the high cost of experimentation, right? It's not just the cost of collecting the data or analyzing it or randomizing, but all kinds of organizational costs, like the time it takes to get approvals is a cost, or the fact that there is a culture of holding our cards to our chest and not letting anyone see what you're working on is a cost, or the fear of failure is a cost. And at the end of the day, this is basic economics, right? If you make the cost of experimentation low, the demand for experimentation will go up. It's Econ 101. The demand for its complements will go up. The demands for its substitutes will go down. And I think we really need to develop now this framework of what it means to push that cost of experimentation out. So I think that's one, right? I think the second thing is really developing that sense of humility. And what I mean by that is organizations, like any other place, are essentially a collection of people with strong opinions, people with lots of experience. And so the number of times, Henrik, you and I have both sat in strategy sessions where people have to make a decision about, should I launch product A or product B, or should I offer a discount or a coupon? And people will come in and say, 10 years ago we did this, and I know based on my experience that A is the better product. And sometimes I sit and say, why don't we just test it out? But there's great reluctance to do that, because what if I test and I learn that my belief was wrong, right? And so that's the other thing we need to develop within organizations, that culture of testing, like Google, right? Like, I don't think they have strategy sessions to see whether the background of an ad should be black or white. I mean, you just test it out. But again, I think that's important. And the third thing is then the agility to be able to act on the results of data, right? And that is another complex piece of the puzzle. It's all very fine to learn stuff, but if you can't modify your product based on what you've learned, then it's kind of pointless. So I think those are the three things that need to happen together: reducing the cost of experimentation, developing the culture of humility, and then the agility to be able to act on the data. Is it an easy process? No. But we've actually, started seeing some early success in working with some government and non-government partners on how best to do this. So I think there's, the road is complex, as Sunstein says in the foreword, but there is a pathway. So I think that's the good news.
If we try to map this out in a concrete and the more specific example here, there is a lot of talk about, and I think with good reason, psychological safety. Mm-hmm. And psychological safety is about reducing the fear of failing in organization, and speak up and speak loud about what you see and register. Mm-hmm. If you take psychological safety, say there is a board meeting, we're discussing how can we improve psychological safety. What will your recommendation be to apply these three principles with reducing the cost? Could you try to map a short experiment on how to improve psychological safety and test it?
So we could certainly do that. I think the first and foremost thing to keep in mind is, and we talk about this in the book a fair bit, the notion of the empathy gap that all of us have with people that experience, in this case, psychological safety or lack of it thereof. You've probably, observed situations like this where the top management will say, we've done all the things to ensure psychological safety. How is it possible that people feel unsafe? Well, talk to them first, right? And so one of the things that we always recommend is to get people who are completely detached from the decision-making process itself to participate in the idea generation process, right? So get your frontline employees, get observers to come up with sort of ideas on what they expect a psychologically safe workplace to look like, get someone to then think through what actually happens in the organization right now, generate a whole bunch of ideas, right? Once you've got ideas in place, I guess step two is really thinking about how do I fine tune and go down to a manageable set of ideas that could be tested in the organization. We use a term that we call the ladder of evidence. There are some quick experiments you could do, which are just maybe hypothetical experiments, maybe collect focus data group, maybe get feedback from people on, via one-on-one to take that large set of ideas into a much more manageable set, let's say 2, 3, or 4, that we can then test in an experimental setting, right? And I think that's the prescribed path that we always recommend to take any idea, be it psychological safety or diversity and inclusion with, in that domain, we've done a fair bit of work in organizations. And then let the data tell us what the appropriate, what the appropriate intervention should be. Again, important to be able to act on what the data tell us. So I've been in situations many times where we've done experiments at the end of which management says, it's interesting that we saw condition number 2 being the best, but we can't unfortunately do it. And if that's the case, don't test it, right? So I think that's the key is really before testing stuff, we want to make sure that these are implementable. But I think that's the pathway, fleshing it out, making sure we don't have an empathy gap, and then test, and iterate till we hit the right solution.
Okay, cool. Thank you for taking us through that specific example here, Dilip. If we look from outside into different organizations and say, okay, how can I identify an organization working behavioral in a behavioral informed way versus a more traditional organization working top down? What is the main point of difference between these two ways of organizing the processes and products?
Yeah, so if you go back to the core of what is a behaviorally informed organization, it's basically one that uses behavioral insights and data to inform its operations, right? And so the question is, can we look for indices? Can we look at observables that will tell us whether they're doing that? You can look at two different sources of cues, if you will. One is the more formal notion. How much experimentation are they doing? What is the extent of the voice of customer or voice of employee that is used in decision making? But you can also start looking at sort of more slightly subtle cues, things such as who is involved in the decision making, how much is the it's not just the voice of customer as in a report, but how much is the customer themselves involved in the process? How many iterations does it take for them to develop a product or an idea? Is there feedback at every iteration? So actually in the book, there is a place where we sort of start talking about all of the ways in which we can start seeing what a behaviorally informed organization does differently. But I think it's really these two big buckets. And I think, so the one other point I will make is, eventually we want to think about the concern that the organization has for compliance with human behavior, if you will, right? And that shows up in how top-down versus bottom-up the decision-making is. And so if it's usually top-down, that's an organization that might accidentally be human compliant, you never know, but it clearly isn't taking the efforts of listening bottom-up. And to the extent that we actually see that there's a lot of communication flows both from top-to-down and bottom-to-up, I think to me that's a sign of a good behaviorally informed organization.
Okay, great answer there. Very informative, Dilip. The last question in this segment is more about standard notion coming, working with behavioral science, applying insights and applying data, using experiment as a way of working through organizational processing, testing different environment for decision-making and framing techniques and so on. People often tend to think like default, this is manipulation. What is your notion and what is your take on that? Because I think you have must heard it a million times before.
I mean, I think it's an interesting question simply because choice architecture or the concept of nudging is very different from a lot of the other behavior change techniques that we can think of. So, for example, you know, every advertising agency in the world adheres to a code of conduct. What can we do? What can we not do? Those codes of conduct are derived from thoughts about ethics. But we have to keep in mind that advertising is very different because you can imagine a world without advertising. We cannot imagine a world without context. Right? So there has to be some context. And so there is always a default choice. There is always a default choice, right? And so our questions about ethics are whether or not the default as is should be accepted, or we should change the default, right? So it's a slightly more nuanced debate on sort of whether it is ethics or manipulation or whatever else, right? My own sense is there are two ways in which we think about this. There's a class of problems where we know that the end users want to change behavior. We know that people want to save more. If we can help them to save more by changing the default or whatever else, right? They're doing what they want to do. To me, this is not a huge ethical challenge. It's called self-manipulation, or the organization helping you manipulate yourself to do what you want to do, I think is not a problem. Second, I think as long as there is transparency in terms of what the intervention is, and people are well aware of the fact that they have chosen a product that uses behavioral science because it is hopefully going to help them, I don't think that's an issue. So I do think it's important for us to have a solid kind of ethical core of conduct, if you will, in the behavioral science. It's going to look very different from the advertising code of conduct, but we do need that. We don't have that yet as a discipline, and it's certainly something we're working on. But again, for these two classes of problems, I think where there's transparency and when people actually want to change their own behavior, I actually don't see that as an ethical challenge at all.
No, I think you're right on that one, Ben, and that is also a very good and clear takeaway message for that one. But here in Denmark, at least, and I think globally, there is a huge discussion now about data ethics also. How do we actually use these data related to, for example, experimentation, and how do we generate data, and how we take new decisions upon data, and where does they come from, and so on. So I think there is a going from the discussion about only context-related ethics, which should be, of course, taken very serious into account, but also the idea of data-related ethics and discussions about that is the future of this issue, I think.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you for segment number one. So, welcome to segment number two, Dilip.
Good to be back.
In the first segment, we talked about what and what is the behavioral informed organization doing, and what differentiated from normal, more normal organization in the way they organization change processes. In this segment, however, we're going to see how does a behavioral informed organization respond better or worse to change than if it was not a behavioral informed. Mm-hmm. So let's try to see what do you think? What's the idea behind working with behavioral informed organization, and how does that better respond to change in the surroundings coming from outside or inside, whether planned change or emergent change, you know, change that you could not foresee?
I guess the key point I would make in starting this discussion has to do with what I'm going to call the stability of the environment in which the organization operates. And what I mean by that is, yeah, we know that human behavior is unpredictable, and we know that things change with time, but there might be some context where they don't, right? So we think about some fairly standard industries like, you know, people buying petrol at a petrol pump for years and years. You know, the tastes and preferences of people have not changed. Why do you buy petrol to get your car to move? Now, of course, with electric vehicles, things are different, right? But in the stable environment stage, or look at a lot of grocery shopping, where before we had sort of, you know, online grocery, COVID-related changes in the environment, it was a very stable game, right? And so I guess the point I want to make is, if your environment is very stable, if history can predict the future, then it's perhaps the difference between a behaviorally informed organization and one that doesn't actually do everything we say they should do, perhaps isn't that great, right? But I think the challenge is that the world is not stable. And in fact, COVID-19 has shown us how much of a flux we are in. And so this is where the differences start to emerge, right? What have behaviorally informed organizations done differently? Well, they know why people do what they do, because of the fact that they're focused on the underlying psychology. And so as the world has changed, they've, I think, been able to cope better with the change, I think is one, right? Second, I think the other thing that's happened is behaviorally informed organizations, by definition, almost have a wonderful mechanism for figuring out what's happening today in the world because of the way they collect data. Right? They're doing quick experiments. They can actually learn what today's preference looks like. Whereas some of the more traditional research type organizations rely on historic data and they rely on scorecards based on what happened in the last 5 years. And they don't have a windscreen in front of them. They just have a rearview mirror. And so they've struggled a little bit, right? And so I guess at the end of the day, it really has to do with sort of the unpredictability of the environment. So, you know, why are we advocating that companies be behaviorally informed? Well, I mean, at one level, you could say, if I have enough experts in my organization, then I don't need to do experiments because these people know, they know what happens, right? But I don't know if you saw, there was recently a lovely book by Robin Hogarth and Emra Sawyer that talked about the downsides of expertise. And this is exactly the point they make. They say, well, expertise is great if the environment doesn't change because whatever experience you've collected works well going forward. But if the world changes so dramatically that everything that worked well yesterday isn't going to work well tomorrow, then in fact, expertise can give you overconfidence because you think you know it, but in fact, you don't. And so I guess as the world becomes more and more unpredictable, as things go more and more into a flux, I think we're going to just see bigger and bigger differences between.
I think Gary Hamel, actually, I don't know if you know Gary Hamel, he wrote the book Humanocracy. He says there's nothing as dangerous as a mid-age white males knowing how the world turns around, making judgment about the future.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Gary's point or Robin's point is an important one. And I think it's something that organizations haven't yet grasped, right? There are two kinds of expertise. There is obviously expertise of history. I know what worked in the past, so I'm going to, you know, I can more quickly retrieve solutions. But there's also an expertise of knowing what's going to happen, the expertise of collecting data, the expertise of analyzing data. And I think that second kind of expertise is going to become more and more important going forward because the past isn't going to predict the future as well. And we saw this dramatically in the last year and a half.
Yeah. So this getting down to experimentation, getting closer to reality, getting closer to context, using real-time data in order to craft solution and design solution that could cope with the actually presence now and here. Yeah,
that's exactly it. And I think in his book, Misbehaving, Richard Thaler talks about the notion of SIFs, like a supposedly irrelevant factor, right? Things like this COVID, so people have anxiety. So that changes the way they think about purchasing behavior. Or COVID causes work from home, changes the way we think about relationships within the organization. These are things that we have no experience with. Like, we have no data on this in the past, right? And so if I use the same rules as before during COVID times, chances are good that they're not going to work. And so I think, you know, the more we live in a SIF-rich world, and human behavior is really an SIF-rich world, we have no way of knowing a priori how unforeseen events like COVID-19 are going to change our behavioral patterns. That's where being in the experimental mindset, knowing what's happening today, actually makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I agree totally. That's a very important point here. So, the other important point, besides the idea of how to respond to unstable environments and being more agile, both on the internal side, working on reacting on the data that you collect from your data, but also giving response to the emergent change that comes upon you all the times, like in Corona, there is the discussion about impact, because as Matt Wallard, another great behavioral designer we talked about when we did the preparation for our talk, said, okay, why don't you show me your data and your actually impact that you create working with a behavioral change technique, and just not just the processes and all these great design charts and so on. So could you dive a little more into this kind of the idea of or the notion of impact? What kind of impact can we see working with behavioral organizations?
Yeah, so I'll give a couple of examples. One in which the impact seems massive, the other one in which the impact doesn't seem a whole lot. But I'll show those two just to kind of highlight the fact that even if the impact doesn't seem like a whole lot when you look at the results of a study, that's actually not the case. So let's start off with a simple example of some work that we did several years ago with an insurance company in upstate New York. This was a company that sold a health product. And one of the things that it noticed was that, so by the way, standard health insurance product, so, you know, it entitled you to a prescription plan and the usual screenings and an annual health checkup, right? And it turns out that, so these were people who purchased this, were people that had actually paid for an annual checkup with a doctor. Only about 17%, 1/7, got that checkup, right? And of course, you know, we wondered why, and the company before they spoke to me had called up a market research agency, and the market research agency had done a whole bunch of phone surveys, and the most common response they got was that people said they were busy to get the checkup, right? Now, you know, sometimes I look at that sort of data and say, well, that doesn't sound right. Like, it's 3 hours, 2 hours maximum, right, in a year. Who wouldn't get their annual checkup? And so it turns out that the solution to this problem wasn't the fact that people were busy. It was the process of having to phone to make an appointment, right? So if we randomly assign people an appointment, and I said, Andre, thank you for purchasing our product. I've set up a doctor's appointment for you on December the 5th at 10 o'clock. If you can't come, please phone us and we'll reschedule it, right? So just changing the default there, turns out a lot more people got the health checkup, right? So the friction wasn't busyness. It was the act of having to phone for an appointment. That's the kind of thing that people keep forgetting, right? We almost doubled or tripled the number of people getting an appointment. Okay, so simple intervention, big difference. Let me share with you a second example with a very small difference, which is this was work done by a colleague of mine, Tanjim Hussain and John List, in a factory in Asia, where they were trying to see what the effect of a behavioral intervention on motivating employees, workers, laborers on a shop floor, right? So these were people that had a particular target for how much they had to produce in a given day. And then they were given a productivity bonus. In this case, it was 320 units, renminbi. And half the workers were told that if you increase your production from whatever it was to the new target, you will get the extra 320. The other half were promised the extra 320. And they said, but if you don't reach that target, then we'll deduct 320. Okay, so same story, simple framing manipulation. I'm either giving you the bonus as a gain, a gift, or as a potential loss, right? These researchers found a very small difference. There was a difference. So when the bonus was presented as you will lose the money, workers were more productive, but only by about 2 or 3%. Okay, so the effect wasn't huge. But if you think about the effect of 2 or 3% productivity every single day in a factory, right, it actually adds up to a heck of a lot, right? And so oftentimes what ends up happening is small changes might have seemingly small outcomes, but they accumulate over time, right? So those are two examples of sort of seemingly large and seemingly small outcomes. But keep in mind that the cost required to get those outcomes was close to zero. I mean, in one case, it was really just randomly assigning people an appointment. In the other case, it was the same productivity bonus, just the way in which it was presented was different, right? So for that cost to even get a 2 or 3% improvement in productivity, gosh, that is really high ROI. So I can actually go on and give you lots more examples, right? But I think there's a lot of output that for the cost is really high.
Yeah, that is like microaction with a maximum of impact. If you keep using them and you reusing them all over time, you'll accumulate these improvements.
And mind you, I think in the interest of fairness, I should also be clear that, you know, for each of these things that worked, there were some things that didn't work, right? And so oftentimes, as we say, the science is iterative. You learn from a failure, you try and update, right? So I'm not saying that every single intervention doubles productivity or improves productivity. But again, keeping in mind that the cost required to test any of these is relatively low, it is worth scaling up because you don't learn without trying.
No, and as you're on your own point, humility about this is also central. I heard a podcast the other day with a professor, I think she was Laurel Newman or something. She referred to an experiment about the default change in organ donations. Mm-hmm. And she said that they learned after the fact that people had died, the family changed this default notion, saying, okay, this was not a real choice because it was per default that they signed up for this. So we changed it so you cannot have the organs now that the person is dead.
That's right. And I think, so that one is an interesting one because I think, to me, that's an example of just a poorly thought out intervention simply because the organ donation situation, as you said, is very, very different from other examples of default, right? Like there are two entities involved. The person who consents and their family both have to make decisions. And there are two stages. There's a decision to consent and a decision of actually removing the organs, right? And so you can't take something that worked in a one-shot decision within one agent and apply it to this one. But even in other situations, I mean, I think I have to say that the number of times in which we try things thinking it's going to work and it doesn't is significant. And, you know, we shouldn't kind of create the illusion that everything we do always works. It doesn't. But again, I think the trick is figuring out that if you can do these interventions, you can try them in a low cost manner, then failures are okay, because it doesn't cost a whole lot. It is worth the eventual success.
Yeah, and it's also that you also create a lot of impact having the conclusion saying, okay, you dumbass, don't go that way again, because we have tried that.
I think that's that. And I think over time, you build a body of data that tells us what works and what doesn't work in which situation. And just having that, I think, is great. Like the number of times you sit in organizations and people make claims for which there is no evidence is kind of stunning, right? And then just collecting these sorts of data and say, well, yeah, you know what? You're right. It didn't work. And it didn't work perhaps because, and then you have a hypothesis. But here's where it worked. And so you can start building a much more nuanced understanding of what works in what situation.
And to your point about cleaning your pipes, I think here in Denmark, we just had a finding that to increase the number of male going to the doctor on a regular basis, you know, their everyday doctor, not specialist, but their everyday doctor, that was online sessions. Mm. That was like a huge, I think it was 60% in
every, amazing.
Amazing. And this is a simple thing, making a context of call. We have learned to be more digital during COVID, but
absolutely.
Also taking this contextual learning from one context and map it onto another and, okay, what can we actually continue to do here to keep have this impact and creating what we all look for, lasting value in our things, mm-hmm. Saying, okay, this little things, cleaning the pipe that way, maybe means a lot. That's a little micro action, but it means a lot in the big picture.
Hendrik, I'm going to say one quick thing, if that's okay with you. I think,
of course,
in a lot of these sessions and business schools, we often advise our students and our participants to come up with the big ideas and the big thinking, right? I actually push my students to think small. And what I mean by that is that oftentimes it is these little things, right? Like the fact that you have a phone to make an appointment that prevents people from doing things. It's not they see the benefit. They understand it. Right, it's just that the friction that we create, which seems really tiny, and then we, you know, as managers, we say, well, how difficult is it to make a phone call? Well, it's not difficult; it just doesn't happen. And so, I think thinking through these really small things is helpful in the behavioral sciences because, again, the small things trip up the big ideas.
Yeah, and I think it's a great point. In my book, I talk about what does it take to apply behavioral management. That's my notion for this thing we're talking about here. That is the courage to think that small is big enough. Thank you for this segment number two, and a good and cool and clear example of how the behaviorally informed organization create impact. Thank you. Welcome to segment number three. Here we are going to make Dilip Soman's how to make it happen list. Three strong principles to work with, start working with as a behavioral informed organization to make change happen. What should that be, Dilip? Point number one.
Okay, I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm going to give a meta principle, then I'll give three specific ones. So I think the meta principle is to always, always, always remember that our stakeholders are humans and not econs. So we need to design for humans and not for econs. We need to assume that our stakeholders will not care as much about whatever it is we want them to do as we think they care. We have to assume that they will forget to do things. We have to assume that they will get confused with choice. We have to build all of this into the way we design products and processes. So that's the umbrella thing, right? Three specific things. I think one is it is really important to build a research infrastructure. And that's key. And I think that research infrastructure could take all kinds of forms. It could be a simple online panel for collecting data. It could be a panel of customers that you can bring in to get feedback. It could be having a trained group of people who know how to do experiments or conduct surveys. But I think that's key. Without that research infrastructure, we're going nowhere because that is the pillar of everything else. Two, I think really important to develop what I call a human compliance checklist. What do we actually mean in our particular organizational context to be human compliant? That could include things like, you know, listening to customer feedback or employee feedback or making sure we don't cause secondary effects of our interventions or our policy programs. I mean, companies spend and take so much time and energy being compliant with the law. We have compliance departments in most companies. I wish we had even a small proportion of that budget allocated to human compliance. Just having a set of checklists saying, here's what we mean by being human compliant as a function of different departments, I think would be extremely helpful. And then the third thing is really going back to the idea of the SIF, avoid off-the-shelf solutions like the plague. Just because some other company tried something and it worked doesn't mean it's going to work for you. Always ask the question, how is my situation different from theirs? And adapt that solution to your situation before trying it. Because if you don't, chances are good that it may not work because your situation is different. And if it doesn't work, then people start losing faith in the science itself to begin with. So I think those three together would be my three pillars of how we design for humans and not for econs.
Thank you so much, Dilip. It's such a wonderful experience also to have you here. You're bright, sharp, and clear, and to the point. It was very inspiring here, and I'm sure that the Danish listener will find that inspiring as well. And I know you have some places that you can go to look more. I know you have a website, so please, can you make some advertising for that here before we zoom out?
We can certainly do that. The website that has a lot of the information we just spoke about is called BIORG Partnership, B-I-O-R-G Partnership.com. And if that gets really hard to remember, all you need to do is to type the words bear, as in the animal bear, B-E-A-R, at University of Toronto into your search box of your favorite engine. It will take you to the bear website that will link you to all of these wonderful resources that we have.
Cool. So in yourself there, you have a little framing of the cleaning the pipes, make it easy to find.
Absolutely. Research.
Thank you so much, Dilip. Thank you for taking your time there from Toronto to talk with me here in Copenhagen. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Dilip Soman, we have just done, and in my world, an excellent podcast about how to make change happen using the idea and the mindset coming from the behavioral informed organization. But why on earth should I go listen to this one, do you think?
Well, you know, every organization is in the business of changing behavior. We have a fantastic science of behavior change. You would think that every organization is deeply involved in the science, but it's not. And there's several barriers for why this happens. And so in this podcast, we'll talk about why on earth there is such a gap between what we think companies should do and what they actually do, and how we can overcome that gap.
Thank you for delivering that pitch there from Toronto. Thank you. And listen to you guys out there. See you soon in your podcast.
Rejsen fra intention til handling er slut for denne gang. Tak fordi du lyttede med til Adfærdsledelse på Lyd. Et laboratorium, hvor vi undersøger, hvordan dygtige, kreative, professionelle, skøre og sjove mennesker får forandringer til at ske. Husk, at det er gennem dine mikrohandlinger, at du opnår maksimal effekt. Alt det kræver af dig er mod til at tro på, at mikro er stort nok. Håber, vi lyttes ved næste gang.